everybody. Time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 237. No big surprises, just Dave and I doing as many questions and answers as we can with a little interesting follow-up. We have some follow-up on Webpack. We have some follow-up on a really interesting one about, you know, all of a sudden you write a line of CSS and you have to double tap on links instead of single tap on iOS. It was a weird bug we brought up before, and we've dug into it and really figured it out. So we'll explain that in this episode. Some follow-up on TypeScript. We have somebody who's trying to make accessibility a first-class citizen as they redo their design pattern library, which is interesting, and have some recommendations about maybe who you might reach out to about that. You know, an old HTML5 chestnut. The old B and strong tag, which one should you use and when? Lovely stuff like that coming up in this episode. It's also brought to you by Hired.com, which is kind of like a reverse job board. The job offers come to you, which is pretty cool. We'll explain to you that and more coming up in this episode. For now, Mr. Dave, kick things off.
Hey shopping maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast about web design and web development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Quoyer.
Remember last time you were like, remember when we used to do mouth bass? And now it's like, yeah. It's back. Apparently it's back in a big way. So we have some errors and omissions and stuff to cover because of some things that we talked about, which has been a theme on Shop Talk. So lately we talk about stuff that we don't know a heck of a lot about. And I think it's fun. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of why I like doing this show, is I get to talk to Dave and we get to think things out. So even if we don't know, at least we can put our minds together and think it out. And it makes us both smarter people and hopefully makes y'all out there smarter people as we go.
So let's get down to it. We got a lot of feedback on our recent TypeScript segment. So the question, I think the original question, if we flashback sounds. What is strong versus dynamically typed? And then why is TypeScript a big deal?
I was the one who didn't know what it was, and I made you explain it to me. And I actually think you got it right.
Yeah. I think I got a B plus, maybe A minus. Okay. But, so we got a lot of feedback and, I have like two here, like hot pieces of feedback from David Hicken and Kevin Kipp, and a lot of people on Twitter have been, kind of like,
there was another one even, but
yeah, people on Twitter, have been sharing kind of like why they like TypeScript and, but all that is kind of,
my thing that I think people that like TypeScript really like TypeScript, you know?
Yes. And I personally was unaware of the passionate TypeScript community. So I think it's good. And I'll kind of like try to, explain. So David Hicken wrote in and, it's kind of a long, like it's a blog post, David. And
you should just copy and paste this whole thing and put it as a comment on this episode, because then other people could read it too. It's too long for us to read.
Yeah, so I'm gonna give some snippets. Okay, I've boiled it down to its curds and whey, and I'm gonna just take the curds. Okay, here.
Okay.
And so just a clarification on strongly statically typed languages versus dynamically typed languages in TypeScript in episode 235. Strong typed languages enforce that a function will get the variable types that it expects. I think we kind of said that, but we didn't maybe say that succinctly. And the variable comparisons will only be between like values. So you can't compare a number and a kitty cat, right? That makes sense. This is enforced at compile time. So you have a compilation step in strongly typed languages and brought to the developer's attention at development time if they are using an IDE. So now when you're in your editor, like Visual Studio or something, it'll say, you can't just add a number in a kitty cat. You can't do that. Those are not the same thing. Additionally, having multiple types of numbers, floats, integers, real, I think there's like long and you know, big nums and just normal integers, and add to processing and memory efficiency. So you can think about this, I think, gosh, you talked about this maybe on a CodePen radio, where you have database fields. Like if you have a text database entry and then like a, or like a one that's like, you know, a varchar 255, like the 255 one is so much faster, or whatever, like just, or if you have like an integer one, it's way faster than the text one or something. So yeah, you can like have memory efficiency if like if your compiler or your runtime kind of knows what sort of object is going to show up.
Could you imagine coding your whole life in a strongly typed language and then trying to switch over to JavaScript, which so many people are because JavaScript is so huge, that you'd just be like, what the smurf? Like, yeah, this thing is making me make mistakes all over the place because you've grown to rely on that stuff. I can totally get that.
Yeah, it's sort of like you enter JavaScript and it's like there's no rules. There's like not even like objects and functions and classes and all this. Like you can kind of do whatever you want. No processing is required to validate that the rules or that the values of like types that the values are like of like types when the variables are compared. So if you're doing an equals equals or whatever it. Or when you join and add them.
And sure, it's great to hit save and get that error output somewhere that you can see. But even cooler, it's in the IDE and it's just warning you in line as you're doing it, which is really pretty neat.
So, and then he goes on to say he hasn't used TypeScript, but there's a he went to a conference where Bowden Kelly gave a good presentation. And there's a YouTube link we'll put in the show notes. And then he's saying TypeScript is JavaScript, but it adds some features. The first, of course, is strong typing, which we just sort of talked about ad nauseum. But what makes this beautiful is it is discretionary. You can add it where you want. You can leave it out where you don't. Something else I love is this only affects your development. Once you compile, all of the TypeScript code is removed. So TypeScript kind of...
it's a preprocessor, like all the, like, obviously Sass removes its Sassness and compiles down, you know? And TypeScript is like, oh, it's ES6 too. So you get all that, you know, like, which I don't think was an original goal of the project, as you said, but you get that for free too. So it's kind of like, you know, using a preprocessor, but you get a bunch of bonus stuff. And the most important thing you get is the strong typing thing, which is no surprise why big libraries like Angular 2 are written in it, because like they need it certainly more than like a little hobbyist making some small little JavaScript thing. It's like, it's kind of four bigger projects. So maybe if I will, I'll read Kevin's comment that's shorter on this. He says, it's fundamentally very difficult to maintain a large JavaScript code base. The nature of dynamic typing everywhere means you give up the ability to check for a lot of type-related errors at compile time and will run into them at runtime. So TypeScript in this strong typing business lets you check for those kind of errors, and it helps big time when it comes to refactoring your code. Say, for example, you're using Angular 2 and TypeScript. You have multiple components sharing the same service. If you make a breaking change to that service, the API, and forget to fix one of the components that uses that API, the compiler will alert you that you have error. So, I mean, that's kind of sweet, and it makes a lot of sense. So, I think we.
So, if my service starts returning a number instead of a kitty cat, like all hell breaks loose, the compiler or TypeScript or the IDE,
there's going to be we'll start saying way like, before you're deploying this thing.
Oh yeah, which would be nice.
Yeah.
So
like testing for free is one of the ways I put it last time.
Yeah. It's kind of like, if you just include this TypeScript dependency, you kind of have a bunch of, I don't know, just kind of, code fences. You have a bunch of rules to keep developers in line, which I think the large projects thing is kind of a big, that's sort of where my code sniffer goes off. I'm sure it works on small projects, but large projects, lots of developers hopping in and out, writing whatever they want. You probably want some sort of enforcement on, right. You know, types in what things return and what things expect. I think you want like probably a lot of that. So thanks everyone for writing in. It's good to know. Actually, I don't know about you, but my view of TypeScript actually kind of went up a little bit.
I thought it was cool for a while. It seems sweet. Although, you know, it's a time investment to, I would think, to figure it all out and get your IDE set up and all that stuff. So it almost seems like something that like I'd get into if I was on a project, somebody else had it all going already and could walk me through it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, all right, well, cool. Hopefully we did half decent over there. Thank you.
You know what I've said before, this is a totally different tone because I've changed my desk up a little bit here recently.
I finally gave up
on the Apple monitor thing because it's just, yes, they stopped selling them and whatever. I went with the big curvy guy. So now everybody I work with pretty much has this thing, the LG 34-inch super wide thing.
Yes. Beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I love it.
It's so nice to have like basically two monitors right next to each other without a bezel in between. It's so wide.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have like, I call it like East Coast and West Coast. It's on East Coast, all the like Twitters and communication-y things go. West Coast is get her done.
I even cracked the laptop open also.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, you got the satellite.
Why not? A satellite, yeah, indeed. But it's nice. And it's cheaper than a single, you know, it's less expensive than an Apple one is anyway, you know. And I don't miss it so far. I think that was a big upgrade. But then I was, you know, playing around on my desk. You know, purchases beget other purchases sometimes. I was like, there's so many stupid wires on this thing. And I've always thought, I think I've even said on the show, I feel like my body has like some kind of atomic thing going on that like makes Bluetooth not work around me properly.
you're like a positive charged entity.
Yeah, I don't know.
Your ions are
brown tooth. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's mostly because like there's a lot of people that use Bluetooth around me and we're always like pairing and unpairing and all that stuff. And I was like, I'm going to get over myself because there's too many dang things on this desk that are plugged in. And like, I have a decent little battery set up at home here. So I'm stopping and worrying about that. If I need a new battery, I'll just go grab one, you know? So I was like, all right, I'm going to get rid of this wired mouse and just go back to one of these Logitech ones I have sitting around here that isn't even Bluetooth, that has a little dongle on it. And that worked okay. But then I'm like, you know what, maybe I'll try it. I mean, Apple literally makes the Magic Mouse. So I bought, like, that's what I'm literally using right now. I'm like, maybe I'll love the Magic Mouse. And the reason I did it is because, like, the Logitech one, I upgraded to Sierra and it wasn't working that well, like that there was some weird momentum things going on with scrolling, and I'm like, well, at least an Apple Mouse will like work as expected, even if it's not terribly comfortable. Anyway, I got that Bluetooth, so there's one wire gone. And then my buddy Tim at CodePen was like, you should check out this Kinesis Freestyle 2 ergonomic keyboard. So it just looks like a right, kind bro. Of have you seen this thing?
No, I'm Googling it now.
Oh, I don't know if you'll love it or not. The jury's still out for me, but it's like, I used to have the Microsoft Natural Ergonomic 4000 or whatever it is. It's a monster. It's this huge keyboard that's got a hand rest on it and stuff, and it's elevated. And so the Kinesis is just like a really basic looking keyboard, but it's actually just sawed in half. So that's the ergonomic part. Is what's kind of cool about that is it's easier to throw in your luggage, you know? It's like a tiny thing. Throw in your backpack. But it's weird. I don't know if you've switched keyboards in a while, but like, holy cow, is it awkward. Like, everything's basically in the same place, but like the size of the keys are different and stuff. So it's freaking me out. But I went Bluetooth with it because I'm trying to get rid of all the freaking wires on my desk. So far, so good. I have wired headphones on right now, but I ponied up for some average Bluetooth ones too, so get rid of that cord. So my desk is finally going to look like one of those fancy designers in a magazine.
Oh man, you could start recording YouTubes with with a wireless desk. I probably need to do this too. I'm about to pull the trigger on a computer. Oh, a new computer, man. I did the Dave Goes Windows and I was like, I'm going to get a new computer. And, then I bought one, and then I was supposed to get $100 credit on this like peripheral. And I was like, hey, my $100 credit didn't go through. And they're like, oh, you have to like cancel the order to like get that. And I was like, that's a bummer. So I was like, $100. I was just like, yeah, I want $100. Like, so I'm going to cancel the order. And I canceled the order. And that day I canceled the order, they're like, Nvidia was like, oh, by the way, we put like, you know, 10 series GPUs in laptops now. And I was like, dang it. I want one of those, or maybe I don't know, but my whole, like, I made a decision and I was like, oh, I'm going for it. And, then it just like it, my order fell apart, and then I have like no computer. I'm still using the Surface, which is good, but it's,
you yeah.
know,
weren't it's you of dreaming a, of it? Was it's been a hot while since you've been dreaming of building your like super gaming PC.
Well, so then I was just like, well, I, if I had the Surface like for on the go, I could like get by with that, and I could like build a gaming rig. Oh my god! And it's gonna be like so fast and so many gigahertz. And I spec'd out a whole gaming PC, which is not expensive. It like $1,400, and you have like you know 10 Mac Pros like smashed together. I mean, like
you can build a pretty baller machine for on the cheapish.
Oh, for $1,400, this is like. I don't know. I could like take down satellites with this thing. It's so awesome. So I was like, oh, this is great. And then the specs on those laptops, the Razer laptops that I've been looking at, updated. And then the tiny like ultralight laptop, that those specs updated. And I was just like, oh, that's nice. Cause now it's like 16 gigs of RAM. It can go up to a terabyte of hard disk space, which is like, I think I want that, but I don't know. Maybe I could get by with 512. But now, man, now I'm just like, oh, maybe I'm back to like my original plan. I do like a tiny laptop with like an external GPU thing, because you can do that in Windows. Oh, man. I'm like, I'm totally paralyzed on what I'm going to do. So I still don't even know if I like gaming rig. But I also come down to like, I don't want to maintain two computers. Do you know that feeling?
Where yeah. You're like, it's like, do you think the future is some kind of cool, like all your... like all your apps and documents and even dev environment, like everything is kind of cloudy, and then you can just like, I don't know. I'm sure I'm like not.
No.
But then you pop open your laptop and it's using that. But you can go to your desktop rig and you get all the like advantages of the hardware sitting there, but it's still all your stuff. That would be cool.
You know, so not to over Dave Goes Windows things, but there's a like Windows has this almost like a Confluent, what is it called on iPhone, where like your Mac and your phone know about like the same continuity or something?
What is that called? I don't remember. I hardly ever use it, but sometimes in your dock a little icon will be down there like, oh, you were using Chrome on your phone, so do you want to like go to the same website on your desktop too?
Which is helpful like 1% of the time, but it's a cool feature. So Windows phones, and I don't have one, but I would consider one. That's where I'm at right now. You like can basically like plug in or wirelessly, if you have like a wireless display, like, you know, almost like a Chromecast display, your phone can be a full computer. You just have to pair a keyboard and mouse and That's display nuts. To it. And your phone is like a full operating system. You could run PowerPoint, you know, Excel.
You're still limited. You're limited to the hardware that's on the phone, you know, which is right. Like no big deal. That's fine. If the phone is super powerful and stuff, that's a pretty cool idea.
But you're like, not probably developing websites or you know, WebGL or whatever. So, but anyway, it's just a.
But how cool would it be to like have one development environment and be like, oh, I happen to be physically near a really powerful processor. So right now it's taking advantage to that. But I can't bring it with me, but I can still bring my dev environment.
That's what I like about this Razer setup. You put in a USB-C Thunderbolt 3 thing, and it goes out to an external GPU, which you can like plug in things to it, you know, whatever gadgets or things you have there, and then like go out to an external monitor. And so it's like you just basically dock your little laptop with all your things to like a supercomputer, and then that's kind of what I want, or a super GPU, a super renderer. So it's, I don't know, it's like external power. I'm so conflicted. I have no idea what I'm gonna do. I could get a full gaming rig today, or I could get this little like laptop setup, so which is gonna be way more expensive, but I like I'm also like, do I want to maintain like a laptop and a desktop? I kind of just want one machine, you know? So anyway, sorry.
The future's trucking along quickly. I don't think you'll regret it, but there's some cool stuff happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's some more follow up. I got this wrong in the last one, but it was something that was highly on my mind. So here's the setup. This has totally happened to me in like, you know, a version of CSS Tricks or two ago. I was like playing around with a mobile version of it, and people were even writing in like, oh, dude, you got that thing where you try to click on a link in an article and it doesn't go. You have to tap it again and then it'll go to that link. And I'm like, what is this? This is not a normal problem. You can click links on phones. I do it all the time. Why is my website the one where you have to click it twice? I cannot figure this out. And I tried different stuff and didn't have a lot of luck, and then was like, screw it, and installed FastClick, you know, which is the kind of nice anyway, because then it like really smokes, you know, you click a link and boom, you're there, you know. It removes all any delay that imparted from clicking on links, which I think that's gone anyway, but you know what I mean? It was just nice. And I just solved the problem by a JavaScript library, but that's never ideal. You know, like what I never really got to the root of the problem. And it came up last week's show or week before or whatever it was like, how is this happening? And we were like, oh yeah. Cause I've seen it just recently again, it came up, and we were talking about how it happens. And it's like, my hypothesis was that it was like, kind of like a multiple leveled menu where like you have a hover event on an LI, for example, and then you have links inside it, and it's that LI hover that's screwing you up, because it's like you'd click on the link that you can see, but I don't know, there was something like that. And I always thought, well, like, if you boil that down, it's like the parent element has a hover, so that's blocking the link. That's not what it is, because I tried to make reduced test cases and figure this out, and then ultimately gave up again and was like, whatever. But Pete Droll wrote in, thank you, and he pointed out a Nicholas Zakis article who explained this back in 2012. So we're not exactly breaking new ground here, but I wanted to be as clear about it as possible, because he really puts a point on it, exactly how this two-tap problem happens. It's like, if you have a link that has a hover effect, and that hover effect, or even a parent element or whatever, and that hover effect hides or shows something, meaning a child node of itself, or even before or after pseudo element, because those are kind of like a child. If that like toggles the visibility of one of those childs, or the display value of one of those, or even it's smart enough to know that if you set the height or width of something to zero, thus not showing it anymore, if that's happening on the link, it will require a two-tap situation, or a parent element with the link inside of it. Or if there's some kind of hide or show action happening, that's what causes the double link. So it happened to him because he wanted to do one of those link properties, right, where you like hover over it and like the underline animates itself under it as a little design effect. Well, he did that by using a pseudo element on the link. So the pseudo element was display none. You hover over it, not only does it display block, but it animates its width too, or whatever. Boom, you got a pseudo element on it that hides or shows itself, you're in double clicking territory. Or you have a div, a parent of that link, and the div, when you hover over it, reveals some image inside of it or something. Oops, now you have a hide show situation. It's going to require that additional click. So there's no JavaScript at all involved here. It's just like you're playing around with CSS trying to do something, and boom, you've like made your links a double tap situation, which sucks. And I think that needs to be explained more. So I think I'm going to work up a little post on it that explains it. I think there's plenty of information out there on this, but it's happened to me a number of times. It totally eluded me, the situation, but it's about hiding and showing child nodes on the links or parents above the link.
Wow. Thanks Pete Droll for digging that up. This is fascinating. This is like,
writing some CSS, broke my site in the weirdest way ever.
Right. How do you can break links with CSS? What a terrible power we have. Because you're just messing around. I'm just going to show this little thing when you click a thing, and then it's like,
yeah, it's the mobile browser trying to be helpful, right? It's because it's people who have hard coded hover stuff into their app and expect it to, and that would be super broken on phones. A lot of websites would be super broken if they didn't do this at all. You know what I mean? This is kind of how sub menus work a lot of time. So this is we can't break all hover based drop down menus.
Wow. That's fascinating. It's interesting this behavior is baked into browsers, and then it's also interesting that just that.
And it's iOS for sure, but I don't know. I should have tested on more things, but I kind of suspect other browsers would have to follow suit on that, in which to like not break the internet, you know?
I would
not break Chrome, the internet by breaking the internet.
Yeah, I would think Chrome would inherit a lot of WebKit's work there. And I doubt that Chrome is like, you know what, let's sit down and rethink mobile clicks.
But it's actually more interesting is like how is like a Windows phone handling this? What is their take on the issue?
I don't know. Maybe Windows needs to send old Dave Rupert a phone. Huh? All right. Let's get going, shall we? Should we take a break? Let's go make some money. Does that sound good? Maybe we have some money coming in.
Hey, all you job searchers out there, people kind of thinking about maybe checking out a new job. You're good at what you do, right? Shouldn't good companies be applying to you? Yeah, heck yeah, I think that sounds awesome. That's what Hired.com is about. I want you to go to this URL, Hired.com/ShopTalkShow. And it's not just so that we can track it, it's so that it's actually even better for you. So imagine this. It's totally free. You go to Hired.com, you put your profile up there, companies contact you, you interview with them, figure out which one that you want, and then you get a bonus for it. Normally, you get $1,000 for taking a job on Hired.com. If you sign up for our link, Hired.com/ShopTalkShow, you get $2,000. So you got a new job, you paid nothing to get it, companies came to you, and you're making $2,000 on the deal. So I think that's pretty awesome. It's kind of like a reverse job board situation. You can go out and look for a job, nothing wrong with that. But you might as well try Hired.com too. See what comes to you. See if an excellent job just lands in your inbox. That's what hiring should be like. Feels good. Let them come to you.
All right, we are back. I hope, or I don't, who knows if we ever make money. Here we go. Ollie Silvati writes in about accessibility. Where I work, we're starting to rewrite our front-end framework. I'm keen to make accessibility a first-class concern in the redesign. Have you got any recommendations on resources, books, sites, people to look out for implementing accessibility standards in a JavaScript app? I've found a couple of books that look good, but are only a few years old at this point. We do have some specific use cases, so anything that dives deep would be great. Well, any ideas there?
Oh my God, I'm the worst at stuff like this, but I do have some ideas. And then it's like, there are some big existing projects that have made accessibility a first-class citizen already, that maybe do you have the opportunity to just grab one of those and fork it and use that as a starting base? Thus you kind of are inheriting that good accessibility, at least to start with, before you start messing around. I mean, I think of things like I remember the Google's Material Design Project or Google Material Angular or whatever it is, where they really made that a big part of it. That's open source. So use that as a starting point, and then you kind of get that stuff for free. And I shouldn't say, well, then you never have to worry about it again, because I think maybe the best opportunity is just if you don't know that much about it, then you should hire a consultant to work with you. So start working on your app, but have them alongside you at all times. And there's definitely, you know, hireable accessibility people out there that can be hired for jobs like this. And make it happen. If you don't know, hire somebody. It's just kind of like, I don't know how to set up my AWS stuff. What do? You hire somebody, right? Well, hire somebody here too.
Yeah. I mean, if you want it to be really good, you'll probably need some consulting just because you're new and you don't know how it works. Just, I don't know, maybe like the first time did responsive or something. I will give kind of two recommendations. I work on a project, open source project called a11yproject.com that tries to be a little bit more forward about accessibility. Got short, succinct articles with hopefully clear answers. We have some patterns, sort of like Brad Frost patterns, but we have like accessible patterns in there. We have a lot of resources so you can find things. But one resource, if you're doing like a JavaScript app in particular, you need to follow Marcy Sutton. She's kind of the maybe the most visible, right? Would you say that? The most visible, like, JavaScripter that is also focusing on accessibility. Oh, and I'm going to add one more person too. Rob Dodson, who's been on the show. Marcy and Rob have both been on the show. Rob Dodson has a YouTube series for Polycast where he talks about accessibility issues and fixing accessibility issues. So follow Rob Dodson as well. But Marcy Sutton has a course on egghead.io. So I'll put a link in the show notes, egghead.io, instructors Marcy Sutton. Marcy talks about, she goes through making a JavaScript app accessible and the kind of just, you know, use HTML. That's like the most important thing is use some HTML. So do that. I talked about Rob Dodson. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm missing.
I know as far as like people to follow and people to read, I know Leonie Watson talks about it a lot. We can put some of these links in the show notes for sure. When I think of hiring people for this kind of thing, I often think of simplyaccessible.com, which is Derek Featherstone and co. They have a big team over there who are hireable for this kind of thing. So check them out.
We've talked about it before. A11Y Weekly is kind of a weekly newsletter, not so weekly newsletter, about it's about, you know, accessibility chatter. So if you want to kind of be on the cusp of that, there's also like, you know, Slack chats and stuff you can get into as well if you want all of that immersion. But
we should throw out that, you know, I think when we talked about this beforehand that, you know, I'm sure you're sick of hearing about it, but Bootstrap has been absolutely grilled for accessibility for how big it is. So that's not the worst choice of things to look at.
Yeah. Yep. So I would, I'm trying to think. Yeah, here we go. So Jeez, loading up the old Linkomatron here. Got the Rob Dodson links. He has a lot of stuff about Polymer, Ask Polymer, Polycast. But look for anyone that's kind of about accessibility. They should say like accessible components with screen readers. And this is going to give you kind of the, Polymer, Angular-y point of view. But yeah, so... Okay, hopefully that helps. Good luck, but also get help and don't be afraid to ask for help from people. I think that's the big thing too. I think all of us are a little ashamed of how little we know about accessibility. So it's important to, it's important to kind of like just share your ignorance and let people help you or, you know, I think it's important. All right.
Lovely. What do we have next? Let's see. MJ writing in a question that's so specific, it appears ungoogleable. I'm teaching myself React, and I want to get more practice working with APIs. My problem is I can't find very many high-quality public APIs out there. I'm developing locally, which doesn't jibe with services like Flickr and SoundCloud because now I'm stuck debugging CORS errors. What can I do to get on with my life and just build websites? This struck me as odd when I read it because I'm like, the whole point of an API, like a public API meant to be digested from other websites, is that it's cross-domain. You know, you're hitting Flickr for data, and it's coming back to you. And now you say you're getting CORS error. So I wonder if you're like on localhost or something, and you haven't spun up a real web server, like, you know, localhost.com or whatever. Or localhost.dev, you know, .dev is a popular local thing. And I wonder if that's what's the cause of the CORS errors for some reason, or there's something else going on. Because APIs are meant to be used cross-domain.
Right, right.
So, like, they should be setting their CORS stuff. If they're not, they haven't on purpose, and they're expecting you to use something like JSONP to get around it.
Or maybe you're not using their API, and maybe you're just kind of hot linking things, you know, that they don't want you to do. That's a possibility too. I was going to say, if you're looking for kind of public APIs, we kind of came up with a little bit of list, but Todd Motto, who's been on the show, has a repo called Public APIs, and it's a list of maybe 100 public APIs.
Oh.
From like, let's, I'll just do the headings. Anime, you like it already. Let's see, drinks, oh yeah, drinking, environment things, games and comics, like, there's a whole Pokemon API.
You know what I think of is, because I see so many of these on CodePen, it's Free Code Camp has a little course, and they suggest people come over to CodePen and build something. And one of the projects that they have people build is like, what are the like open, most popular like open streams on Twitch TV right now? And so the students build like a what's playing on Twitch app, and there's 20 zillion of them on CodePen, which is good. It's people learning how to use APIs. But so that means that Twitch has one. This is a really nice one. deckofcardsapi.com. It's just a URL that is just an API that returns you, you know, stuff about deck of cards. You shuffle it, how many cards are in the deck right now, how many are remaining, is it shuffled or not, what's an individual card when you pull it. It's just, if you wanted to practice you building a card app or whatever and didn't want to manage the cards yourself or whatever, or maybe you do, but this is just a, I don't know, giving it to you for free right away. Deck of Cards API is really good. You know, I used to work at Wufoo. We had really robust public APIs. So it's like collect any data through a form and then access the data in those forms via API. You know, GitHub has an API.
Oh, my favorite. Is it api.github.com/zen? Is that it? Yes, api.github.com/zen. It'll just give you a little one-liner of some zen, just some code-based zen.
Nice.
And I think there's even an OctoCat version. Let's see, OctoZen. Let's try that. Nope. OctoCat. And then maybe it just brings, yeah, do slash api.github.com/OctoCat. We'll just give you a random OctoCat saying one of these zen quotes. So there you go.
I was trying to think of this one by this guy, John Brown from Portland. This is John Brown that had a, what's it called? Uncontext? Maybe that's what it was. There was a, yeah, Uncontext provides the world with a socket that is streaming data in a structured format 24/7. So it's like an API that blasts random numbers at you, essentially, through a web socket. And the idea is that if everybody builds stuff on this, that there's like some kind of like beautiful earth art that's happening, that like everybody's getting random numbers, but you're all getting the same random numbers.
Mm-hmm. That's kind weird. Of wow. Yeah. There's a lot. I mean, you know, if you, any app that you use will probably offer some kind of API for you to play with, for the most part, but
lots of stuff out there, MJ. What do we got here from Scott?
Scott Fowler writes in, anyone used Adobe XD for mockups yet? Question.
You inspired me to put, I had downloaded a long time ago, and it inspired me to throw it down in my dock just to see if I'll, I have not used it to actually build something yet, but I downloaded it way back when it launched, and then I opened it again, and it was like, this needs a major update. Oh, so I updated it again.
I have not used it. It is not on Windows yet, so I do not have an opportunity to use it. But I would like to, because I never got on the Sketch train. Can I confess this?
Well, also not for Windows.
Also not for Windows. So I never got on the Sketch train. But you know, for this type of stuff, type of mockups that Dave Rupert does, which are just basically sketches, I feel like XD or Sketch would kind of be like in my wheelhouse. Just like you put a button here and then you put some text in a button. I don't really do like, you know, Photoshop mocks and filters and, you know, anything of that matter. So I feel like Adobe XD would be up my alley. I just need to use it. So, or I just need
it. It's a real basic prototyping tool, and I think they're doing that on purpose, you know, to kind of rethink how things work and operate in these type of tools. And also, I wouldn't doubt, like, through the being scared of Sketch a little bit, because Sketch just really kind of in what it seems to me came out of nowhere and took a lot of customers, because it's kind of sweet.
Yeah, well, I mean, it takes, you know, it's kind of the joy of Illustrator or the joy of Photoshop, but it takes out a whole bunch of the the cruft, you know.
Yeah, the UI is really good. Like, you always see that layers panel there. It's like this along the left, and it's just always there, and it just everything seems to work just how you kind of hope it does.
And how they do artboards too is
really nice. Yeah.
Well, just on any website, you need to see more than one panel of the website while you're designing it, or app or whatever. You kind of need like a heads up of everything. You can't just like have just one single
take
pane.
On. This is actually just for screen design, where it's like Illustrator, it's been around forever. It's hard for them to just be like, well, Illustrator has multiple artboards, but it's not straight up for screen design. None of the apps Adobe has is straight up for screen design. So that's, I think, what XD is going to grow up to be, you know?
Yeah, I think, like a for screen design app is kind of revolutionary, as weird as that sounds, you know? We've been using tools that are for whatever, but
so neither of us have used it, Scott. Not like all the way. Like, I literally have it open right now and I'm like drawing circles and stuff in it. So maybe I'll do it. But I think one of the reasons I haven't, was one of the notes I put in here, is that this is going to grow up to be a blog post someday, but it's about muscle memory in tooling and just how you approach web design and development and life in general, is that you maybe even read about stuff, know stuff, are open-minded to stuff. But when you really get going on a project and you're just like, I'm just going to work on this thing. Like, somebody asked me to build something, I'm going to build it, or it's my job right now, or I'm assigned this task. Once you just get going on it, you just do what you've always done. You just reach for those same old things or whatever. And I've been talking about SVG for years and have the book on it, and I'm just working on a new talk. I give it early next week. I'm going to Orlando for AEA Orlando, and I have a brand new talk about SVG, and it's made it into that a little bit too. I think people are like, more and more people are aware of SVG, but it's still not taking hold as far as something that's just in people's muscle memory of a thing to reach for when doing images on the web. It's like they're aware of it, and then they get going on a thing and they just don't use it.
Well, I think it's very tough to like just switch software. Like, I'm just going to use something different now, you know? Like, that's a tough decision. I use it, I mean, total opposite end of the spectrum, but I'm using PowerShell, like, day to day. And, like, I come from Bash, and I like Bash, but I've, like, switched to PowerShell. And so now Bash is on Windows, and it's, like, effort to, like, start using Bash on Windows. Isn't that weird? Like,
yes.
It should be like, oh, home, I love you, like my old friend, let's hang out and, you know, do things together. But it's like, well, no, I kind of already like retooled, so we'll get back together though. You know, it's like an old partner or something. It's like, hey, we'll get back together, buddy, you know. I don't know, Chris. It just got weird. I anthropomorphized my software. I don't know. I'm trying to think of like other things I just use just because, but, well, we've been changing software for, we can't say it cause it's top secret and we don't want all the podcasters to use it and then our service goes down. But we've been using different software instead of Skype for podcasting, and it's been good, right?
Oh,
it's
man. It has been good because I was invited on a podcast that I don't think will be out until like later in November or something. But it was Skype, and they were new to podcasting, and I think just chose it based on, I think that's just the obvious choice usually for talking to people online in a way that is cross, you know, browser platform operating system friendly.
Kind of everyone has a Skype, kind of. You know,
right. It's just a little, I don't know. It feels like a bigger ask to be like, we're going to do this on Hangouts or whatever. I don't know why, but it just does kind of. And there's nothing else as universal as Skype. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we did it. And my Skype was just horribly misbehaving. You know, and how many, we've did hundreds of episodes on Skype. I'm familiar with how Skype operates. It's not my favorite, but it's a thing, you know. And it just would not connect, or when it did connect, it wasn't showing me as online to anybody else. And I did discover that they have a web version of Skype that's pretty full-featured, which was pretty impressive. So that worked a little better, but still didn't quite connect when the actual call came in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like a totally it's just Skype in the browser. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, Windows 10 has a new Skype, like a Skype preview, I guess is what it's being called. And it's kind of that version. It's that web version. I think it's probably just like a React app or something. But it's pretty nice. And like, I don't know.
It didn't work, web but technology. It looked nice. Yeah. Well, anyway, so.
It sounds like my website. So.
I don't know. I think I eventually got to work, but it was just one of those things like, oh, I'm so sick of, you know, I need apps that work, and we switched to one that works.
Creature of habit, you kind of just use the thing that sort of isn't super good, but you're just using it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Speaking of that, this Electron thing, it kind of came out of nowhere to me. Maybe I'm sure there's been people that have been using it for a long time, but 1.0 is out. Now, like, everybody in the world's rewriting their stuff in this.
Oh, yeah? Sure, well, when is CodePen getting an Electron-y? Huh? Huh? No comment? Okay. Fine.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it requires server stuff, but so does everything else. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. Maybe it would be a smart thing to do. I don't know.
I don't know. I could get you a Windows app. I just have to wrap it up in a universal Windows application. I could have that on your desk by the end of the day. CodePen.exe.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt. I mean, certainly people have like packaged it up into browser extension and stuff before, and
yeah,
standalone apps and stuff. And I don't quite see the appeal. Not like if somebody wants to do that, that's okay. But like, there's some, there's some technical debt to things like that. That if we stamp it as this is an official thing that we support, then it has to be an official thing that we support. You know, it can't just be a thing that we decided on a Friday afternoon to do. You know.
Right. So, yeah, if you make it, you have to support it forever.
So. Brett B writes in, he's asking about B tags. No wonder, Brett B. There's a lot of B's up in your life. this is a silly question, but I'd like to address with you. Utilizing best practices for HTML5, what's the best way to format text to make it bold or italicized outside of the stylization of a CSS class? I'm wondering what's the best way to make text bold or italic. So some argue that a span tag with font weight bold as the style is the best way. In my research, I came across using B to make font bold stylistically, or strong to make more attention to the text from a hierarchy standpoint. The same argument is made for I and M as well. I know that the B and strong tag are in, you know, HTML 2, 4, 5, whatever, and are reverse compatible. I guess what's best practice from your point of view? He says, writing span, style, font weight, bold, end span, every time you want a bold text seems like overcoding to me, but hey, color me a novice.
So that's kind of... Yeah. Don't do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine a situation where that's a good idea.
So weirdly, this like couple weeks ago from when this episode comes out, I wrote a blog post about The Web is Ruined and I Ruined It by David Spiegel, written in 1997, that also addresses some of these questions about I and M text. But I think it boils down to this, like B and I have no meaning. They're basically shorthand for span, style, font weight, bold, span, style, font weight.
Yeah, top, right. That's right? What was my understanding is too, is they're just in the user style sheet to apply font weight bold. So you use it when you need to make something bold, but not emphasized. Kind of like, I don't know, like you're following the style guide of the world for citing something in a table of contents and it's supposed to be bold, but you're not actually trying to emphasize the author. You're just trying to make it bold.
Right. I guess I like, if you have like just a string of content though, like when are you like, I guess that's an example, or maybe
here's like one, like sometimes I want to emphasize, like I don't want to use a code tag in a sentence for something like, oh, then you go to the file save thing in your menu, and I want to somehow call out file save, but I don't want to make a code tag because it's not code. I don't really want to italicize it. Sometimes I'll just go with a B tag because I'm not trying to emphasize it either. I'm just trying to like set it apart from the text around it.
Yeah, but is that not strong?
Strong is emphasize. Well, I don't know. Yeah, strong would be like, I really love Dave Rupert or something. And
yeah,
I would put really in as strong for some reason, but maybe it would be strong. I don't know.
I don't know. I think B and I have fallen out of fashion. Strong and M are what you should probably use in most cases, but guess what?
It convolutes the issue when you see like the B button, like in a WYSIWYG editor, and you click B to make it bold, but it puts a strong tag in there.
Oh, and people are still so mad about using I for icon fonts. Oh my gosh, people are still so very angry about that.
Oh, I don't like it either for some reason, because it just seems like it's a span, but if it's like, oh, it saves three characters, I'm like, oh my god.
But it's like an I for icon. It could be whatever you want. Here's the thing. The computer doesn't care. Like, the screen reader doesn't even care. In theory, this is what everyone says. In theory, the screen reader can, you know, make a funny accent when it reads emphasized text. And
but nothing currently does that. Yeah.
Nothing does it. Nope.
So so it probably is fine, but would you use an X tag? You know, like that doesn't exist. So that probably, you would probably draw the line there, right? Or no?
Yeah, I would draw the line there, but you know, would I use sup for super cool text? Probably. Would I use, I don't know, whatever. I don't know. I don't know. It's like this weird, like it's, there are semantics baked in, and it is, you know, that's what markup is for. Markup is for marking up your intention. But you know, the secret is the computer doesn't care.
So mostly use strong and M. If you want to bold something and absolutely not emphasize it for some reason, use B and I.
And having, like, being a person who, we just migrated somebody's database and they had a bunch of inline styles, like style equals font weight bold. And I had to like manually sanitize that and like rip out all this text. Don't do that. Don't do that. So no one wants that. That's silly. So, because it was like they like started sneaking in colors and, you know, it was probably old WYSIWYG barf that I was cleaning up. But man, it's a pain. So don't do that.
We have something a lot more heavy to bring to you from Alyssa Hope, who writes in about what aspects of security are a front end responsibility. So right away, she mentions things that very much are front end. I've heard of setting a content security policy to protect against XSS attacks, and that iframes and other HTML5 elements could be a liability. But getting a handle on this and understanding what is expected of me as a front end developer is difficult, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. Wow. You often think of security, and this is, God, we really could use a show on this. We've had notes to try to do a show on this forever, and we have big plans. So I know we say that too much on the show, but here, that's the deal. You often think of, like, what was the Yahoo one and that happened recently and whatever. You often think of these things as, like, there was a data breach. There was a massive web security problem, and passwords were compromised or credit cards were stolen or something. And it's tempting to think of those as like, well, that was a back-end thing. I'm just a front-end developer. Somebody got into our database. That was just kind of not my job, you know, or like, I don't know, like, I don't know about that stuff. I don't really consider that a front-end. I don't consider salting passwords a front-end responsibility, you know? And I'm not trying to argue against that. I don't either. I don't know that much about that stuff. I mean, just from what we do at work and that kind of thing. But yeah, I'm not in charge of that kind of thing. But as a front ender, I really do think about things like CSP. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this before we get into all that?
I've been getting, this has been kind of my side project, and I'm going to say something and I'm going to regret it. Is that okay, Chris? Can I say, make regretful statements? I've been thinking along like similar to the accessibility project, I'd like to do a web security project. So if you're interested in that and helping out with that, and hit me up. I am actually deathly afraid, because the second you start talking about security, the second you like start getting hacked by like Russian botnets. So I don't want, I want to also wade carefully into this, but I think like every developer should have the tools and the know-how to hack their own sites. I feel like Dave Rupert should know how to exploit DaveRupert.com, like do a full exploitation test suite on DaveRupert.com. Just like Dave Rupert should also know how to use a screen reader on DaveRupert.com.
I don't. And I wouldn't know how to hack your site. I would think, like, because I know so little, I would think my best bet, just from my past experiences with hackers and stuff, is I'd probably try to figure out who's hosting you, and I'd probably call them on the phone and be like, listen, this is definitely Dave Rupert. I, like, lost my driver's license, but it's definitely me. And, like, can you just hook me up with, like, my SSH password or whatever? That's all I need from you. It's no big deal. I'm paying you for hosting, so, like, please, you know. And then maybe I'd get a little angry. I'd be like, listen, I've been paying you for 2 years. All I want is my SSH password. Give it to me right now. I'm calling your manager or something like that. I'd give that a shot, you know, see if I can get it. And if I got it, then I'm in. Then I don't need to know any fancy stuff. I'm just in. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, that's another whole other side to hacks and things like that, is like you have the social engineering side where I just pretend to be Chris Coyer and I get into your website. There's also, like, you know, the two-factor authentication. We kind of all kind of know about that, right? Like, you basically get a text every time you log into GitHub or something like that.
So if I had access to your repo, I could probably do some stuff too, right?
You could. So in theory, Chris Coyer could, like, insert, you know, links to Russian spam site inside FitVids, commit to master. I probably was sleeping. I didn't know because you, like, hijacked my email too. And so all of a sudden FitVids is like and people who are hot linking it from like raw Git or whatever.
Oh yeah. So that depends. Do I make that change to the master repo of FitVids.js? And when people pull the new copy, then it pulls this vulnerability too, which is mostly just XSS because it's just a JavaScript file. But having that access, I could do XSS, which could be bad for you.
Yeah, well, it just ruins the life of the repo. So you kind of need, like, two-factor authentication to get into thing, you know, crucial.
But sometimes things. You can just write to, like, when people's WordPress site gets hacked, sometimes the actual theme files are changed. Sometimes somehow they get access to write to JavaScript files and PHP files. So that has to do with the permissions. You know, maybe they got in through SSH, but maybe there's just some way that your server writes those files. And in fact, have you seen in WordPress, you can go to, like, the editor area and you can actually change theme files right through the WordPress admin itself. That means something from the client side has access to make requests to write those files. And it's probably pretty locked down, but, like, there's some kind of, that's some kind of attack vector there.
But if somebody guessed your username and password to your WordPress site, they could log in. My WordPress would never text me to say, like, oh, Dave, are you sure you want to log in right now? Right. You know, so, like, you can just log in and get in. And, you know, even two-factor authentication has a weakness with that social engineering. Somebody can call my phone company and just say, oh, hey, this guy needs, I need you to, like, basically give me a new SIM card. I need it. I just got this SIM card. Can you activate this SIM card? And then all of a sudden my texts go to some other person's phone now. So my two-factor auth is totally cracked. And that, what a weird world. Anyway,
what Alyssa's asking about is, I mean, a lot of those things still feel like back end stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the, like, line is very like murky, you know, because, you know, let's say I can type script alert hi in a menu or in an input, and if I can get that to execute on your front end, in theory I can start, you know, sniffing cookies and stealing things. Maybe your JavaScript was you were doing inner HTML from that content I put into a text box, and all of a sudden I can, like, basically, the theory is once I can inject code, I can basically execute whatever I want. I could steal cookies. I could, like, start making database calls or whatever from a text box on your website. So that's where things like, you know, sanitizing, you know, content security, XSS, or like CSRF, I think. That's where those things sort of come in.
That kind of feels a little front-endy because the CSRF tokens are set as a meta tag, although I still tend to not think of it as a front-end thing so much because it's like, dude, that thing was created and injected by Rails or whatever, and just kind of happens to be in the form and just...
But that's... To sort of prevent somebody from just like auto scripting your site. You just say, I require this thing. If this thing is not here, do not do a thing. Like, cause, and so that's, you know, that's a bonus, but you know, the chance that you coded something to break that is pretty high. I feel like it's easy to wash our hands of this as designers and developers, but like there's actually a lot of stuff, you know, I think little vectors that we open up by accident. I read this, I think I sent it to you, Chris, the other day, this Hacked Back. It's basically this, it was a website, but I like just pulled, it was like a text website and I pulled all the text cause I didn't want to be on the website too long. Cause I was like, what if he's hacking me? So I just copied and pasted all the text into a text doc. It's called Hacked Back and it's like a DIY guide about this person who hacked the, I think it's called the Hacking Team, which is like a government agency that does hacking. And so it's a hacker hacking this government agency. And one thing that he says in there is just a few little like off comments, but he's just like, no SQL is basically like no security. And I was just like, ooh, what do you mean? Cause I don't understand. Like, are you for serious? And it kind of makes sense. I mean, I don't always secure my Mongos or whatever. So anyway, I'm sorry, we're not being very official here, but I wanted to point out this website called observatory.mozilla.org from Mozilla. It kind of came out recently, and it's basically you type in your URL, and it gives you a grade on how secure your site is. Right now, daveruper.com is getting an F, and don't hack my site, please. But it's getting an F. I am not doing something awesome, so I need to do better, for sure. For sure, for sure. I need to do better. So,
The one that you mentioned, Alyssa, content security policy, is a very big deal. And it feels front-endy in that you put a file in the file set that says what things are allowed. And the big thing that it prevents is like the execution of any inline JavaScript, or you can, I think, even tell it don't execute any JavaScript except for from these domains that I whitelist, kind of thing. And that goes a long way for XSS stuff. It's really good for that kind of thing. So if that's the one thing that you know about and are good at and do, that goes a long way for front end security.
Yeah. You should definitely do that. SSL is a big thing too.
Oh yeah. It's tricky because they're kind of, all these things kind of cross, you know, like it's weird to just say like, this is a front end responsibility. This is a back end responsibility. There's more gray area between all this stuff. Like, is HTTPS for all front end? A little bit, but a little bit back end as well.
If there's a Venn diagram, these are all in between, you know, because this is where the data starts going in between. I think it is a developer's responsibility. I think we should all have to bone up our knowledge of it. So if you are interested in whatever, talking with me about it or like trying to figure things out, let's do it. But because I don't know if my tinfoil hat is getting very thick and heavy, and it's a scary world, and there are bad people who just cruise around doing bad things just for fun. So you got to kind of be careful and lock it down.
Good luck, Alyssa. Good luck, Dave, with your new project.
I know. I just got myself hacked, so I'm miserable. But sorry, myself.
Let's see. This is just another errata that we'll end with really quick, because I probably should have put it at the top for that reason. But it was awesome when we were talking about Webpack and stuff, which we could probably do more follow-up on, because we got some on this. But John just makes 5 points about what it also is talking about Webpack. And it's kind of why he likes this world of Webpack specifically. So he says, number one, all projects have a dependency on NPM to start, you know, or whatever. It's a very popular thing these days. So even if you're going to use Bower or Gulp or Grunt or Browserify or whatever, you still have to use NPM. So NPM is kind of like a given dependency already. Got to have NPM.
Okay. Got it.
Yep. NPM can install most, if not all, third-party assets, even if they're front-end these days. Angular, jQuery, React, etc. Those are all on NPM. So there's no additional dependency beyond that. Number three, to use a third-party vendor on the, like if you download React from NPM, it's kind of like it's tucked away right into a node modules folder, and it's like weird and whatever. You need to use some kind of tool to like get access to that in a normal kind of web development kind of way. So you need something like Webpack or Browsify or whatever, so you can like import those things and it knows about that structure. So he's like, okay, I pick Webpack because of that. I can just like NPM for my React and then just import React from React and rock and roll. I'm using it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So number four, because I picked Webpack already now, it has a great dev server for local development with change watching and that type of thing, hot module replacement. So it's like, okay, I picked Webpack, and now just as a bonus, now I have this great local development server, and it has hot module replacement, which is great, which means that you have opened some React component or whatever, you hit save on it, it doesn't refresh your browser, it just replaces just the little bits that it needs to replace and just keeps going. It's like CSS injection for JavaScript. It's amazing. So his fifth point is done. NPM run. It replaces the need for grunt and gulp and all that stuff that it would be doing. And it can kind of do a lot of those common stuff anyway, like bundling and minification and processing your SAS and less and all that stuff. Anyway, you can make Webpack do that. So it's kind of like, I don't know, you got to have NPM anyway. Why not just put one additional dependency on it instead of like a whole bunch of them?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he likes it, and I think that's why it's becoming popular. People are fighting back against too many dependencies, and it almost feels like Webpack is fighting against that a little bit, and that there's less dependencies when you just go all in on Webpack. It's still another dependency, though.
Yeah, well, and you get into Webpack, you're using Babel, you have to do the Babel loader, the Babel preset, the Babel, you know. It's not, thanks, John. I think you're right. Like, you have NPM to start. Why not just use that to be your package manager? Don't do the Bower route or the manual cut and paste. And then you need something to pull those out of the node modules. And then you need a dev server. So why not just use, I guess he's using Webpack as his dev server. But I guess I don't, does it
you
do that?
You kind of have to, if you want the hot module reload.
Okay. Okay, I've just only used Webpack as like the file watcher sort of thing, so I've not experienced the server side of it. But let's say that's good. I think that is a reason to use Webpack. There's a lot of stuff you're going to, I guess, benefits. I'm on team like reduced dependencies. I think I read recently Babel, you know, it was like, why is Babel a monolith? Like, why is it a giant app or whatever? And it's like, probably for this reason, just like we have too many tiny dependencies that could go wrong or something. I don't know. I'm just not on like team Webpack. It's not my go-to tool. Again, what we talked about early in the show. It's just not I reach for it because I'm like, oh, yes, that one does it. It's not my go-to.
Hmm.
So I don't know. Maybe one day it will be, but not right now.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny how you're sometimes largely a one-man show in some of this stuff, right? It's kind of what you pick goes kind of thing.
Sort of what I pick goes, but I also try to like be smart about what I pick, you know, or I usually try to like go with what the technology wants. You know, you do a React app, they sort of, you know, default to Webpack and default to ES6 and default to, you know,
mm-hmm.
This is kind of all features of, or kind of the ecosystem of the, it's the ecosystem of React that sort of determines that you should use this stuff. And you know, can I use Ant or whatever? Yeah, I can. I could use make scripts to do all this stuff, but I'm not going to. I want to use what the documentation is kind of all using. So, and that can get you into weird space. But, you know, like Ember is totally different. Ember has this CLI that kind of does all this stuff for you, and it's kind of awesome. And so, like, you probably don't even worry about Webpack if you do a lot of Ember, because it's like, oh no, Ember figures that out for me. So,
right on, y'all.
All right. Well, hopefully we answered some questions, fixed some errors and omissions, and did not incur more than we fixed. So if you like this show, Starheart, favorite it up in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to tell your friends about it on the Twitters or Facebooks or whatever. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for 11 tweets a month. We are up to 11. Kind of a shocking breaking news there. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/job. Get a brand new one. Companies want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else?
ChopTalkShow.com.